You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Some of them are just so fucking weird. You know, this one made it into the game. I forgot we came up with this. The Incredible Gary, he'll suck your nipples. it's The Incredible Gary, camel cased, and then comma, he'll suck your nipples. Okay, I'm not clear on why I'm here. I think someone emailed me and said, would you come on my podcast? And someone who works for me said yes, which may or may not have been a mistake. I guess time will tell. But here I am. Hello.
Hi. My name's Joe. I'm the co-host of the first podcast. And with me, as always, I have Lars.
Hi.
Hi, Joe and Lars.
You are our special guest today. Joining us from, where are you? East Coast?
I'm in Chicago, Illinois.
Chicago. Joining us all the way from Chicago, it's Max, one of the creators of Cards Against Humanity. Max, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
What kind of stuff do you guys want to know? I don't know. I'm a guy. I make games. I work on political campaigns.
You are the creator of Cards Against Humanity, or at least partially so, correct?
I'm a co-creator of Cards Against Humanity. There's 8 of us who made the game together.
Cool.
Okay. And approximately when was that created?
2009. Well, we probably, that's a complicated question. We like first prototyped the game and started playing around with it in like maybe 2007, 2008. And then we made it available to the public in 2008 and did a Kickstarter 2009, 2010 over the new year.
We don't want to ask you any of the questions that you've specifically mentioned not to ask you. So let's focus on what you do want to talk about. And It says here that you're interested in crowdfunding.
Sure. Is that what it says?
That's what it says. That's what my notes are telling me. So we could talk about that for a little.
Yeah, sure.
A little doozy.
All right. What do you guys want to know?
Have you used crowdfunding?
Yeah, we started Cards Against Humanity with a Kickstarter. I've started almost every creative project I've ever been involved with on Kickstarter. I have a bunch of Kickstarters in the works right now. I think it's a good tool for artists to get stuff in front of an audience and take some of the risk out of making new and weird art. I like that it disintermediates the artistic process so that people can connect directly with their fans.
And for the members of the audience, I'm pretty sure probably just about everybody knows what Kickstarter crowdfunding is. For those of you who don't, it's basically a way for somebody who has some kind of project to engage directly with the fans who would normally have to go through investors or fund it on their own or something like take out a loan, something like that, right?
Yeah, I mean, if we, you know, back in, Cards Against Humanity was one of the very early games on Kickstarter. And at that time, you know, we had come up with the idea for this game. We just posted it for free online. And honestly, all we ever wanted was people to, you know, it was something we made and it was silly and it made us laugh. And all we ever wanted was to put it in front of people so that it would make them laugh. Because it was one of the first things, you know, me and my sort of nerd friends had worked on where we were like, man, this is really good. Like, other people will like this. And had we gone the sort of traditional route and gone to like publishers, distributors, you know, gone to Walmart and been like, hey, would you carry our game? they all would have been like, do we curse on this podcast?
Yes,
is that okay?
You can do that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. You can say whatever the fuck you want. Yeah.
Like they would have gone like, well, what the fuck is wrong with you guys? Like, no, this isn't a, you know, like it was a pre Cards Against Humanity world, right? So people would have been like, yeah. What is this thing? Like, who wants this, right? So what was nice was like, you know, we said, hey, we need $4,000 to print this, and that was more money than any of us had. And, you know, we connected with a couple thousand people and they all threw in a few bucks and we did a big first print run.
I guess kind of the thing about Kickstarter, which I've always kind of felt is there in the back of my head and probably was much more of a thing back in the day, is the kind of feeling of like, well, who the hell are these guys and why should I give them my money? And my question, I guess, it's kind of a vague one, is how do you overcome that? How do you overcome this just thing where it's like, oh, I feel like, oh, I'm just giving someone my money. Like, I feel like that's probably inherently unnerving for people.
Yeah, but, you are. That's what it is, right? You're giving someone, you know, as an artist, you say, if I had this much money, I would do this thing. And you connect with a bunch of people and they're like, I'll give you some of that money. And then you can do the thing or not do it and steal all the money. I mean, they're, you know, now they're, I mean, I it's interesting because I've spoken a lot about Kickstarter and traveled with them. Yeah. And I've been very excited about the potential of Kickstarter for artists for a long time, you know, before it was popular and people knew what it was. And we always used to get asked that question. And every time we'd go somewhere, someone would say, what if someone steals the money and, you know, takes the money and runs? And it just doesn't really ever happen. I mean, sometimes people try to make something and it's unsuccessful. And that's part of it, right? That's the deal. Is like, if you're basically becoming a patron of cutting edge art and new things that don't exist, on the one hand, you're going to be the first person to get a new thing and you're going to help put this great thing into the world that would not exist but for your involvement. Now, I think that's pretty cool, but it comes with some small risk of this bleeding edge new thing. Like, it might not work. It's possible. Yeah. It's happened before. I've backed hundreds of Kickstarter projects and I've maybe had two, I think, where they just took the money, right? Usually they'll refund the money. And now there's been, you know, class action lawsuits and things like that. I mean, I've also had friends who did Kickstarter and they ran into some sort of hurdle where it looked like they weren't going to be able to produce their project for whatever reason. And either someone has stepped in to help them or I've stepped in to help them. So I've been helped part of sort of recovery efforts for some Kickstarters like that. But that's the deal, right? There's always been patrons of arts. That's sort of how arts have worked historically. And in a system where, you know, art is something where you, well, here's my opinion anyway, I don't necessarily think it should just be up to the free market to decide what kind of art gets made or not, right? Like, because then you only get the most popular commercial things. You never get the weirds. You would never get a Cards Against Humanity made because at the time, the free market was not, everyone thought we were out of our minds, right? So we were doing this new thing. And now, and in retrospect, looking back on it, yeah, it was a good idea and it had a lot of potential and it would go on to become pretty popular. But like, no, everyone thought it was so weird. It was like, who, you know, they were like, who's this for, right? Like, families aren't going to play this. Like, who's going to buy this thing? Like, what audience does this serve? And that's why art patronage is important. And it's a model that's been associated with, specifically with fine art since ancient times. I mean, you have the Medici family in Florence that's why all this great fine art is in Florence, because they were finding these crazy artists and, you know, Da Vinci and whatever, and being like, here's some money, go make something weird.
Could you speak a little bit more about what made Cards Against Humanity different than other games at the time? But you mentioned that it was not really a family focused game.
Sure. Well, so there's two things. The first was just the content of the game. I mean, an adult party game. If you go to Target now, there's like an entire shelf of adult party games. Like, it's a genre. But I think people should remember that didn't exist really before Cards Against Humanity. I mean, not meaningfully. I mean, there are a few out there, but like, we really like defined this whole category. And now there's like I said, you can go on Target and there's like 20 black and white card games for grownups, you know, that have swear words on it or whatever, which is, you know, what I guess flattering. I don't know. It's weird. But
you guys were the first.
Yeah. But like, we just made this thing for ourselves. Like, we never wanted to sell it or to get money for it, or we didn't make it to be popular. We just made us laugh. So there's that aspect of it, of like, we just sort of created this category. I think, you know, what was also interesting is we've never really tried to market Cards Against Humanity to like the gamer audience. We've always just made it for regular people, and we're like, hey, this is just a game that anyone can enjoy. There's very few rules. You know, we don't say how you win, or we don't say when the game ends. It's designed to be more like a toy that you can just sort of play with. And for that reason, it's been very adaptable, and it goes into people's everyday situations. So they play it in their dorm room, or they take it out to the bar. And I think that's kind of cool and fresh. And it was a new direction that I didn't see a lot of people doing before we sort of figured that out. But the other thing is, we're an independent company, so it's just we're just eight guys, right? Like we just made this thing. We didn't ask anyone's permission. We don't have any investors. We don't have any VC. We don't have any debt. We don't have a bank loan. We never sold any stock. Like, it's the eight of us. The business model is, we make a product and we sell the product for money, and then we spend less than we make. And that's all there is. And, you know, there was very early on, someone at the Chicago Sun-Times like wrote an article about us, and they were, you know, sometimes journalists want to tell both sides of the story. So it's like, they don't just want to tell a story of like, oh, here's this card game that people like. They want to be like, oh, there's controversy. So they found some like UChicago economics professor who was like against us and was going to say why we were going to fail. And he said, their business has the sophistication of a lemonade stand. And then like, that was a big insult. And I always thought that sounded pretty cool. But I think that's another interesting characteristic of what we've been about, is just simplicity, like not getting huge, we're just happy making this game, making people laugh, and doing a really high quality execution where possible.
And it's growing over time, right? You're releasing expansion packs.
Yeah, we make all kinds of weird nonsense and comedy products and things like that now.
I'm getting a comparison in my head, which is obviously imperfect, but the story you're telling just reminds me of the show Family Guy, where, you know, in the past, it was perceived that the market for cartoons was kind of just for kids, at least in America. But it turns out that there actually was something that people didn't know they wanted in terms of more adult entertainment, of a classically more family-friendly media. And do you think that's kind of what's going on with Cards Against Humanity?
Sure. Yeah, maybe.
Okay.
You heard it here first. The answer is maybe.
I don't know. Who the hell knows? Maybe. I think a lot of times these things are like, you know, you're in the right place at the right time and you get lucky.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I don't know how much credit, you know, it's like, how much credit do you want to take, really? Like, I think we got lucky. We made something that spoke to people at the time that we made. You know, we started working on this at the end of the Bush administration. And I think there was this, it was a really culturally and politically a very crazy time in America. And it felt to me, at least, like there was this real breakdown of authority and of meaning and of language. And, you know, we were mired in these like two wars, and there was an economic collapse, and we lost like a major American city because of a storm. It really felt, I don't know if you, how old you guys are, but if you remember these times, it was very distressing. And I think there was this real breakdown of language and words and meaning and authority. And cards felt very au courant. Like, it felt like it fit in with that framework. And then we went through 8 years of Obama, and I don't know. I think the game has adapted, and I think it's interesting to see now. It's, to me, feels like maybe this kind of humor is becoming more relevant under a Trump presidency, but we'll see.
Yeah.
You know, with your question about like, was it like Family Guy? Why was it successful? I was talking about, I'm learning magic tricks. And I have this teacher, Jordan, and I was talking about creating tricks or something with Jordan the other day. We were talking about like art, you know, the sort of creative process. And Jordan was like, you know, and I was asking him, I was like, how did you come up with this thing? And he was like, you know, sometimes you're making a sculpture, right, out of marble, and you're chipping away at this thing for weeks, and you're chipping away and you're chipping away. And then one day you hit it a little too hard and the penis falls off, and you're like, ah, shit. But then other people see it and they're like, oh man, I love this. It's crazy. I love that it doesn't have a penis. It subverts the patriarchy. And you're like, and then, you know, a couple years later, you're talking about it and you're like, I remember when I had the inspiration to make this statue without the penis. So it's all, you know, it's sometimes it's just contingency, and, you know, you get lucky, you're in the right place at the right time.
So Cards Against Humanity is basically a game without the penis, is what you're saying.
Sure.
By the way, one of the sort of unique expansion things that you did several years ago was a Hanukkah giveaway.
Yes.
I don't remember if it even cost anything or not. Maybe you just signed up for it. But I got a lot of socks from Cards Against Humanity that were too small to wear, but I still have them. And then I got a couple of cards also, which was very nice. As a Jewish member of society, felt good to be represented within the Cards Against Humanity's field.
Well, it may shock you to know that all 8 of the co-creators of Cards Against Humanity are Jewish.
Wonderful!
And we hired 2 head writers, and they're also Joe Feldman and Julia Weiss, and they're also Jewish.
That's wonderful news!
Yeah, so at the time of the Hanukkah pack, every single person who was writing for the game, or the vast majority of them anyway, were Jewish. And we still got called anti-Semitic for doing Hanukkah jokes and Jewish jokes. So, you know, go figure.
I never thought you guys were anti-Semitic.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. But, you know, it's 2019. Jews can be comedy writers. You know, anything is possible.
Anything's possible, yeah.
We're breaking some boundaries.
Jews in the entertainment industry. Who would have ever thought?
Wow, yeah. What a surprise.
Maybe someday we'll see a Jewish banker.
What do you think of this Jewish kind of scream that I've been working on? Who would have thought? Jews in entertainment! That's a good...
Oh, that's very good. Very anti-Semitic. It's great.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, it sounds like... Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
I was kind of channeling like Adam Sandler or something. Okay, Gilbert Gottfried. Yeah.
I think that would be funny if you read some Jared Kushner quotes in that voice. That could be a good bit.
All right, I'll keep that in mind.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, I have a question about that, by the way. And, I mean, the answer might just be like a straight yes or no, but I'm kind of curious if the Jewish heritage influences Cards Against Humanity at all.
Yeah, I think it does, actually. So I think comedy, this is like such a trite observation, but like there is something going, there is some sort of relationship of comedy and Judaism. Like there just is, like, I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
Maybe it's like genetic, right? Like we're like 1% funnier than the general population, or it's something about growing up Jewish. You feel a little bit like an outsider, and that's the beginning of the comic perspective. I don't really know, but there's just something there. I couldn't put my finger on it, but like a lot of the funny people I know are Jewish, and I don't know, man. The probably smarter people than me have thought about that. But so that's one component of it. The other thing is there's this idea in Judaism called tikkun olam, which is like fixing the world, and it's, you know, it's like what you're supposed to do with your life. And I think with cards, it wasn't ever our life plan to like become successful at making a comedy card game. It was just sort of this thing that happened to us accidentally, and we got very lucky. So I think we've also tried to use the success of Cards Against Humanity to give lots of opportunities to other people and really help foster a creative scene in Chicago, and also give a lot of money to good causes and things like that. I think we've raised, I don't know, over the last I checked, it was like $6 million or something for different political causes and charities and things that we're involved with.
I always thought that maybe one of the reasons Jews are funny is because of all the horrible things that happened to us. And you kind of learn to laugh in the face of danger or misery or something like that in order to make the best of a bad situation.
Yeah, it really is every Jewish holiday, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a feast and...
Yeah, it's like, well, they tried to kill us and we were a little too clever and they didn't get all of us and now we're going to have a meal.
Let's eat.
Yeah, there you go. So you were talking about the concept of success in regards to Cards Against Humanity. I kind of have a multi-tiered question about that. For starters, where do you see yourself as a person and as a company in terms of the line of success with Cards Against Humanity? And also, is this something you're going to be doing indefinitely? Is this just something you're always going to do until you die? Or do you have plans for the future? You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, so I always felt like the Kickstarter... I was skeptical when we were doing the Kickstarter and we set our goal at $4,000. I said, that is... We needed $4,000 to do the... We called our printer and we said, what's the least we can make? And they said $4,000. And so we were like, okay. And I was really nervous because I was like, we are never going to make $4,000 on this game. And that number is too big. And so we should scale down. But we couldn't get it any lower. So that's what we asked for. And we did well. We made like $15,000. And then I said, well, guys, that's it, right? We exceeded that $4,000 by like 3 times. So we've peaked. And then we made some more games, and those sold. And I was like, man, that was fun while it lasted, right? But that's got to be the last one. And then we did a second printing, and that sold out. And I was like, you know, every time we sell a game, I'm always like, well, that was fun while it lasted, guys. I'm glad that we had this crazy journey together. And it's been 10-ish years since we started working on the game, and it shows no sign of dying out. Like, we're still making new stuff, and people are buying it, and the game is still growing, and we're getting into, like, retail and things like that. So, I don't know. I mean, part of me thinks maybe, you know, how long have people been playing, like, Scrabble or Monopoly, right? Like, maybe, like, and we keep updating the game, right? We meet several times a year, and we overhaul the, every time you buy Cards Against Humanity, we want it to be the best version of Cards Against Humanity that's ever been on the market. So we're constantly going through updating the pop culture, taking out jokes that don't make any sense anymore. You know, obviously, like, we had to go through and take all the Obama jokes out and put Trump jokes in and that kind of a thing. So,
yeah,
as well as just the comedy sensibilities of society change over time. And we want to grow and change with that so that, you know, the idea is, like, at any point, a bunch of college kids could go get Cards Against Humanity, play in their dorm room, and it's going to be super funny. And they're not going to be like, you know, what the hell is this? You know, who the hell is, you know, Britney Spears or something like that, right? Because that, you know, it's like when we wrote the game, we had a lot of Britney Spears jokes because she was like the biggest pop star of the moment. And, you know, you got to grow and change and put a Zendaya joke in the game.
That reminds me, one time Lars and I were on our way to a concert, and there was a girl working behind the counter at this Greek restaurant that we ate at, and I thought she was really pretty, so I asked her out, and her name was Brittany. And she gave me her number, and she said, oh, you spelt it correctly. A lot of people spell it like Britney Spears. And I said, who? and she pretended not to know who she was. And she said, you don't know Britney Spears? She's as famous as Miley Cyrus. And I said, Miley who? Long story short, she did not text me back.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think there's a reason she didn't text you back.
Yeah, so lesson learned.
But, okay, so Max was talking about getting on with the times and updating things, and I think we should go ahead and do that ourselves and talk about our newest sponsor, Joe.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. So why don't we do that now?
You would tend to agree?
Is this a real sponsor or a bit?
No, this is a real sponsor.
No, we have sponsors.
Oh, okay.
This is a real podcast.
Should I not make fun of them?
Well, I mean, that's up to you, but we'd appreciate it. We're sponsored by our latest.
Shut up.
Yeah,
our latest sponsor.
Don't actively be hostile to them. Thank you.
Lars, you want to do the big reveal?
Yeah. Okay, so here's the thing. A bunch of people on the Discord have been asking how they can help support the show in a way where they're not spending extra money per se. And I know a lot of you guys are on Amazon, so we went ahead and landed them as a sponsor.
We became Amazon affiliates. Yeah. So
Amazon.T1Podcast.com.
Amazon.T1Podcast.com. Go ahead and bookmark that link. Next time you're going to buy something on Amazon, go to Amazon.T1Podcast.com and buy it instead. And you'll be supporting the show without spending any extra money.
How do the listeners know that you're going to, if they do that, that you're going to use the money to make the show? Why don't you take the money and run?
Well,
they caught us. Now, the truth is that every dollar that we get in proceeds for the show goes right back into the show in terms of advertising, in terms of better equipment, and more. There are other benefits that you can get by going to our Patreon. We'll discuss that later, and we can answer that question more in full. But for now, the truth is we know you guys shop at Amazon. They're a bit of a controversial company, I know. But I know you guys like Amazon Prime. I know you guys like to get things very conveniently. And if you're going to get it there, it's a good way to help support the show. So
Amazon.T1Podcast.com.
T1Podcast.com. Thank you. Anyway, let's move on.
So when it comes to comedy writing, do you have a process? Do you make a glass of hot tea and sit down on the beach that doesn't exist in Chicago or something before?
You know, I'm so I have a different, so Cards Against Humanity does definitely have a process of how the game gets made, which I can go into. My own personal process of things that I work on alone, I really am sort of like a diva about it. And I know because I talk to other writers that I really look up to, or I think they're more productive than I am, or, you know, whatever, they're just better writers. And, you know, they all say the same thing, which is it shouldn't matter. Like, all you need to write is a computer or a pen, you know, pen and paper or whatever, and you should be able to write anywhere on an airplane or a hotel room or whatever. But for me, I really do need that, like, I need, like, you know, white noise, and the lights have to be just right, no one can bother me, and the temperature has to be just so, and I, you know, it's like, I'm really an inveterate procrastinator, and you know, I'll take any excuse to not write. It's very painful for me to, like, get started writing. But in terms of how we work on the game, that generally happens as a big group. So we have a writer's room that works pretty independently. But then when me and the other co-creators get together, we do these retreats. We have one of them coming up in a few weeks, and we rent an Airbnb somewhere, usually pretty remote. So we like to go out in the desert or the middle of the woods, or, you know, just somewhere where we're sort of away from everything. And we all sit there and we get a game, and we will pick a black card and start coming up with funny answers for it and brainstorming jokes. And we'll work really intensely for about a week, and then we'll do that a few times a year. And that's how most of the writing of the game gets done. Plus we have weekly video chat meetings where we do some work as well. But yeah, a lot of the process is, you know, you riff. It's a little bit like podcasting. Like, you riff, you try and make people laugh.
I'm just curious. You mentioned that there's a very specific process for when you're writing your own comedy, and the temperature has to be just right and the lights have to be just right. How did you stumble across those things? Like, did you go to write one time and the lights were a certain way, and then you just, a light bulb went off and you're like,
yeah, don't you guys have your thing of like, oh, I can't possibly work, my pencil isn't sharpened correctly.
I have a cup of coffee next to, like, when I'm recording the episodes, like right now I have a cup of coffee on my left. I have a fan that has four light bulbs in it, and I take out three of them. I took out three of the light bulbs, so there's only the one that's facing away from me. That way the light doesn't get in my eyes. Mm-hmm. I have a towel over the window so that the light doesn't get through the window. Stuff on the walls. Like, I have, like, jackets and just, like, towels and stuff hanging and posters and soundproofing around the walls just to get rid of, like, electric noise and stuff. But I'm just curious if there was ever any moment where you were like, you know what? The lighting was this certain way. I can never go back again now that I've been exposed.
Yeah, I mean, I built a little, you know, I spent years, like, working on this great, this really cool office in Chicago that Cards Against Humanity shares with, you know, we invite all our friends to come and use this office. And, like, that's where we have this, like, awesome podcast studio. And I spent all these years, like, designing this office and working on it. And then it was like too busy for me because people need me for stuff. So then I spent a year building this, like, home office, and now I have this awesome, like, studio in my basement where I can go shut the door and, you know, work on my own. And now that's driving me crazy because I'm like, oh, I should spend thousands of dollars to keep, you know, I should get better lights, or I should do this, or buy better furniture, or this or that, or my chair's not comfortable. It never stops. Like, you always, I'll do anything to just not do hard work. Like, any excuse I can think of.
I could relate to that.
Clearly.
Could you describe what your sound studio that you're recording in now looks like? Just visually?
So our office is, we have a big sort of warehouse building in Chicago, and half of it is office space. So it's people's open office plan, people's desks, conference rooms, things like that. And the other half is a public venue. So we have a comedy theater, 100-person, a black box theater that we do comedy shows and stuff in. We have a print studio where we do all of our own design, print prototyping, things like that. And then we had this other room. And when we moved into the office, we knew that a lot of people in the office who, you know, worked in games or podcasting or, you know, media or some sort of thing like that, we knew that basically the thing that everyone was going to do was either going to be streaming or podcasting. Like, one of those two would be important to all the people in the office. So we just sort of left this room unfinished, and it was, like, you know, white walls, and we threw some folding tables in there. And in one corner, we built a little streaming set, you know, like plywood, like super, super kind of low budget, and some cameras and stuff, and got a little mixing board so we could do, like, live streaming. And then on the other side of the room, we set a folding table up with some microphones and a little podcasting setup. And we just kind of let it rip for a year, and we were like, we'll see what people do. And at first, I think people were doing all of this stuff, and there was a lot of experimentation. And I think for us, what we decided was streaming, you know, on, like, Twitch, basically.
Yeah.
We were getting more viewers, but they sucked. They weren't good. So they didn't spend any money and they complained all the time. We just didn't like them. There was like a bad audience. Like I just would rather not have those people as our audience.
The
I
audience
guess.
On Twitch.
I don't know. It was the people, you know, when we do a live thing on Twitch, people would come and they'd make weird comments or I don't know. And then they wouldn't spend any money. So I was like, I hate these people and they're not giving us money. So
yeah.
what are we doing here? Right. Like, you know, you in those moments, I think as an artist or a creator or whatever, I think you have these moments where you pick your audience and it's very easy. You know, if you're chasing numbers and if you don't ever stop and think, you can wind up with this audience of like assholes who you don't really like. And I definitely saw that simmering on Twitch. But meanwhile, we had all these comedians and cool people coming in and starting podcasts and they had a much smaller audience. So, you know, a tenth of the listeners or whatever, but they were amazing. They were like really supportive fans who would write thank you notes and fan letters and send mail in. They would give money and their people were getting sponsorships and making money doing this. And I was like, well, this is like clearly the way to go. Like this is the good one to do. So Alex is like our senior producer at Cards Against Humanity. I sort of asked her to design a really cool podcasting studio. And she worked with all these people from WBEZ and, you know, different audio engineers. And we sort of learned about all this cool state-of-the-art podcasting stuff. And we built what do we have here? 3, 5, 6, 7. It's like a 7-mic studio. So we have like a sound booth and a recording booth and all this kind of cool, like live monitoring stuff. I don't know. It's a professional ass, like radio studio kind of a thing.
What kind of mics do you guys have? You know, often.
We've been through a lot of different ones, and what I'm talking into right now is the Electro Voice RE20, which I think is a pretty fancy radio microphone.
That's cool. Lars and I both have Blue Yetis.
Nothing fancy.
Yeah, the Blue Yeti is great. So we've made the decision to do digital microphones. So everything that we're using is XLR microphones. Yeah. It does go into a digital system, but we're not like, it's more of like a radio station in the sense that everything is going through a mixing board and it's going through XLR rather than like USB getting plugged into a computer.
Lars.
Yeah, I prefer the XLR system myself. We have plans eventually to put this into a studio ourselves, but right now it's the USB works better because we're kind of connected over the internet and it's really simple. But yeah, there are advantages and disadvantages to both of those. I actually had a question, by the way, from a little bit earlier, just to rewind a little
All
bit.
Right. Mm-hmm. Rewind.
Which was about the, you were just talking about the card writing process. And this might be a really difficult question to answer. But my question is, how do you guys determine that a card is funny?
I mean, so it's a very complicated question, good. We think about it a lot. So the first thing is it doesn't make us laugh. Like it sounds stupid, but like there's so many systems people have to decide what jokes are good or not. And like humor is very subjective. And in my opinion, you can measure it all different ways and you can put numbers on it and focus group it or whatever. But ultimately, you know, one of the nice things of our independence, meaning like we don't have a publisher, we don't have a distributor, it's just us and our fans, and we just do what we want and put it out to the fans. No one ever gets to tell us what jokes we are and aren't allowed to make. And at the end of the day, we publish a game that makes us laugh. And that's the first sort of bar of like, there's also times when our writers come up with something and they're really high on it and it doesn't get us. And it's just, that's the breaks, right? It's our company and we're just like, sorry, we're not feeling it. And there was one the other day, our writers had little Debbie and her mom, full-size Deborah. And this was like the writer's like favorite card. And it just, we were all just sitting there scratching our heads going like, I don't know. It's a very complicated joke. Like it's, I don't know. And like, what is it? It's two people, right? Like in the way it interacts with black cards, like what is it? It's two people who don't really have any care. Like what characteristics are there of little Debbie and her mom, full-size Deborah? Like it's just it's sort of a pun. Like there's a lot of reasons we didn't like it, but you know, that was one where it was like very popular in the writer's room and just didn't make the cut because it didn't clear that bar of making us laugh. So that's the first thing. But we do actually test things. So we get real life people together. We play the game with them. And, you know, our it sounds simple to say, but or maybe our obvious or whatever, but like our mission statement or our goal is to make people laugh. And we've definitely discovered that there are cards that we think are funny, but when we put them in front of people, instead of making them laugh, it makes them upset. And then they're not laughing. And so it does not fulfill the mission statement of making people laugh. And so that another question we get all the time is like, where's the line? Is there like a joke that's too offensive that you won't print? And like, no, there's no line. Like, we'll do whatever we want. But
the chat is asking, by the way, not to interrupt you, but the chat was asking that specific question many, many times.
It's an interesting, no, there's no line. Like, we don't have some document of like, you can't say this word. Like, we'll do whatever. But the mission statement is we're here to make people laugh. And there are cards, like I said, like we put it in front of people and we have them play. And I've been in those rooms running those tests where something comes up and we think it's funny, but it just like crickets, people feel uncomfortable. You know, it's like those moments that kill the party and make people feel bad. And as a, maybe there's other people who want to do comedy that makes people feel bad. And I leave that to them. But for me as an artist, I just want to make people laugh. That's my goal.
Mm-hmm. I just want to point out, by the way, that hearing the phrase Little Debbie and full-size Deborah, that's funny in and of itself to some extent, but I can't really imagine how you would play that in the game as a card.
Exactly. Now, and we're guilty. Like, we do put cards in the game sometimes that don't play well, but they have to, like, we would just call that like a jokey joke. Like, it's just something that makes you laugh on the white card. And we'll slip a few of those in there because we fall in love with them and it makes us laugh and, you know, fuck it, it's our game and we get to do that. But we pick very carefully. You know, you get a few in there. But Little Debbie and her mom, full-size Deborah, does not make the cut.
There's a surprise factor to Little Debbie and her mom, full-size Deborah. Like, you're not expecting to hear it followed up with that because you don't think of Little Debbie as having a mother, let alone with the same name. And people are usually not described as full-sized.
Yes.
So there is a surprise factor.
Or little, right? I mean, it's the whole thing. And I think, I mean, to me, that joke works on this level of so you start reading, so it's read out loud, right? And there's this moment of Little Debbie, and you're almost like going through in your mind your little pile of index cards going, Little Debbie, Little Debbie, Little Debbie, oh yeah, food, you know, the food brand, right? And then her mom, full-size Deborah, and then there's this moment of like, what is happening? And then you connect it, and there's this like burst of recognition, and there's this surprise factor, and it's the first time you hear it, I think, I like those jokes where you have to connect two wires in your head. You have to do a little bit of the work in your own head. And then when you connect it, you feel clever. And there's this moment of shock and laughter. But how good is that the fourth time you hear it?
Right. I feel like it'd be good in like someone's stand-up routine or something. Just maybe
it's
not in the game.
Fine. It's not a bad joke. It's just we only have 600 cards in the base game of Cards Against Humanity. And each expansion is 300. And we're sometimes looking at thousands of cards that we pick between and we're editing and arguing and, you know, there's something that we like, you know, in that moment, there's something that we like better than Little Debbie and her mom, full-size Deborah.
Are you familiar with Cyanide and Happiness?
Oh, yeah.
We interviewed... I
love those guys.
We interviewed two of the creators, Dave and Chris, and Dave was describing the boardroom basically when they're coming up with new ideas. And it kind of sounds similar to what you guys go through. I'm not sure if it's exactly the same, but where they're just kind of screaming over each other to get their ideas out there. It's like, no, it's got to be this. This is the best. And it's like, no, my idea is hilarious.
We tend to get more heated about punctuation. I think that's a lot of our biggest fights. Look, the fight that almost broke up the Beatles is usually over like a semicolon or a... a comma usage or something like that.
Okay. I'm not sure if I conveyed not necessarily as much like of a fight as much of like excitement about one's ideas.
We've been through that where people are like lay down on the tracks and like, this is the funniest idea of all time. And if I don't get this in the game, like I can't move forward. You know, it's like we've had that, but also like we've been doing this for quite a while. And I think it's good for the creative process for it to be a little dispassionate, for it to just be a product, you know, like if you go to the doctor and you have two surgeons and they're screaming at each other and they're fighting about the procedure, you're like, how is this the best way? Like, you know, shouldn't there be a little sort of dispassionate scientific inquiry of like, you know, okay, well, here's the merits of this argument and that argument and let's move on and solve the problem. I think that's at our best. That's how we approach it. I'm not always even the best at this, like, cause I'll for me, there's some, also sometimes there's a joke that just like repulses me and I'm just like, I can't abide this, like going in the, like, I can't. And then I just have to, like, it's like 12 Angry Men. I'm like, surely someone has to agree with me that this joke is, you know, beyond the pale, or it's not funny, or it doesn't make any sense, or whatever. I mean, there was one, like, we had a big, this was, I don't know, 5 years ago or something, but we were very divided, almost 50-50 on the card, the best taquito in the galaxy. And I was on the side of, I don't get that joke, and I don't like it. It's like, why is it the scale of the galaxy, and why is it a taquito, which is like not, it's like just a thing that was at Taco Bell. It's like not a real food. Like, it just, it feels like it's trying. So, you know, this idea of like, never let them see a sweat. Like, you want to be a little cool. Like, this card to me is just covered in flop sweat. Like, it's trying so hard, the best taquito in the galaxy. Like, we're just like, someone notice us, please.
Like, random for the sake of random.
Yeah, like, it just really put, it just, it was a card that I just couldn't connect with, and it was 50-50, and that was like our, it was like our you know, like Appomattox or something. Like, we just had this huge, like, Civil War battle, you know, where we were duking it out over this card, and we were like, you know, what are we doing with our lives? How can we put this card in the game? And someone else is like, I would be ashamed to publish the game without this card in it. And but usually it does. That's one that stands out in my mind just because we had a big fight about it, but usually it's not that heat. Usually we just sort of move. We have enough ideas that we'll just move on to the next one.
By the way, have you met Chris and Rob and Dave?
Yeah, oh yeah. I love those guys.
They're cool. But earlier you mentioned that sometimes you take a retreat to the middle of the forest. Now, does it have to be the dead center of the forest, or is it okay if it's like adjacent a little bit to the, like, do you pinpoint where center?
We usually just go to an Airbnb that has a lot of bedrooms. That's honestly, we don't want to share bedrooms. So we've become like too old and cranky and fancy to share bedrooms.
So you don't airdrop into the very dead center of the forest.
Oh, like a PUBG map where you're like, okay, let's drop on hospital. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh yeah. It's not a Fortnite match is what you're saying.
No,
yeah. There is actually a serious question from the audience, and it's, I think this is the first time we've ever asked one, is a sustainability question. If you're down.
Sure.
Okay. So, middleman from the chat, which people can access, by the way, by going to discord.t1podcast.com to tune into these live, middleman is asking, I've always been curious about how Cards Against Humanity develops its workplace policies and production practices to reflect the values that it supports with its charity work and activism.
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk about that. So I think there's a lot packed in there. So let me talk about the environmental stuff first, and then I can get into some workplace stuff. So first thing with environmental, I mean, there's the first thing I'm going to say is, like, we're making a consumer good, and a lot of it winds up in landfills, and I think I'm haunted by that, and I think it sucks. And but also, like, I mean, I don't know. It's people are going to. Everyone's going to have their own answer for this, but like some products should get made and some products shouldn't. And some people should buy some stuff and other stuff probably shouldn't get made. And for me, I've decided that I think this game, it is a kind of political commentary, and it brings people together and it builds community and solidarity. So I think for me, it does have this sort of social good. The other thing is it's all paper for the most part. We've actually rarely made anything that's not made out of paper. So we always look at recyclability. Yeah. We look at all of the coding and the process that goes into the cards and make sure that everything is up to scratch. And we use what's called a FSC certified stock for our printing. So what that means is it's all of the paper that is in Cards Against Humanity is. I'm hearing sound effects. Are you still there?
Yeah, I was just doing my sound.
Yeah,
effects,
the connection's like, kind of bad at the moment.
Sure. My rainforest effect.
That's right. So, I was hearing like Discord noises. I thought maybe we disconnected. This must have just been on my end. Sorry. So everything is FSC certified stock, which means all the paper that Cards Against Humanity is made of is paper that was grown to be, is trees that was grown to be turned into paper. And, you know, paper is quite recyclable. Mm-hmm. Like you put it back under the ground and it turns into dirt. So, cards is probably not the thing that's gonna, you know, be the tipping point that destroys the planet. But that being said, us and everybody listening to this, I mean, everybody should probably become way more radical on climate stuff if we want to survive on the planet. I just don't, if I thought that it would sort of like end global warming for us to stop making games, I would consider it, but I don't know that that's going to do it. I think we probably need, I think it's, I sort of reject, for me personally, like, I just don't know that it's like these like individual consumer decisions, like using a reusable water bottle and a, you know, a cotton grocery bag. I just don't think that stuff is a substantial contributor to climate change. I think it's like, unfortunately, I think it's like United States energy policy, and that feels, yeah, in a way, bigger and more scary to change. But that is where you're going to get, you know, 90% of global emissions, and these individual consumer decisions, like buying a card game or not, are I don't think that's the big problem that we need to deal with. So that's on the recycled paper stock and all of that. But then the other question, workplace culture. Yeah, I mean, we're all eight white Jewish dudes who started the game. So as soon as we could, and we hired a staff, we tried to hire a really diverse staff to sort of like balance out the company and give us sort of other comedy perspectives, because we're all basically the same person. So diversity, very important to us. And we also just have a generous like workplace. Like, we have 4 weeks of paid vacation, pretty you know, generous like holidays and sick days, and, you know, work from home policy and all kinds of stuff like that.
I'm just curious, since you mentioned holidays, do you give Hanukkah off in the high holidays as paid days?
Yeah, I think people just get a certain amount of days that you can take off for religious purposes, or if you're not religious, you can just take them off to, you know, eat candy or whatever. So
yeah.
Also, hi Alex
didn't include her audio track on the file, but she said something really funny here. Tune in live next time so you don't miss these bits.
I remember when I was in it was either 7th or 8th grade, I was in attendance at school every single day out of, it was either one of the semesters or the whole year, where I was going to win an award for perfect attendance, except that I missed one day for Yom Kippur. And it was, and basically I was, I don't know, at the time, that I remember my parents were making the argument, it was like kind of discrimination, because I would have won the award if it wasn't for the Jewish holiday, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's really good that you.
Yeah, the final thing I'll say is like the game industry. I mean, I don't know that this is so bad. I don't know that board games are really the like worst part of this, but the game industry in general is really known for like crunch, for having this like really toxic workplace culture where you're sort of like sacrificing your whole life to make, you know, Mass Effect 17 or whatever. And we really, there's been moments in our company's history, you know, leading up to a convention or a big product release where like, people are working late and they're working hard, but like no one's sleeping at the office. Like no one's neglecting their family. Like I hope that we've created a workplace where like people come in from, you know, 9 to 5 or 10 to 6 or whatever their work hours are. You try, you know, you work hard for a few hours and then you go home and that's your life. And most people at Cards, I would say, have other projects, creative endeavors, things outside of Cards that they're doing, and some of them make money from it, and some of them it's just an art. But I think that makes us a better, you know, I think some companies have policies against that, or they have rules against that or whatever. But for Cards, I've always felt like for the most part, it makes us a better company because people learn stuff and then they bring it back and it becomes part of the creative process in our company.
Mm-hmm. So you would not consider implementing a procedure, not a procedure, but a policy where they have to stay overnight, but you'll provide like masseuses and libraries and stuff like Google?
I know that's a bit, but there are like, totally real. Like in the video game industry, crunch is, people do sleep in the office. They do little bunk beds under their desk, and that's just part of the expectation. Is like when you're working on the game, you're, you know, oh, everyone's crunching. Like, you know, it's like there's no rule that you have to stay there, but everyone does it, and it's just part of the culture. Yeah. And it's hard to. Yeah. I've had those. Listen, my background is working on Democratic campaigns and elections, and crunch is obviously, for obvious reasons, very much a part of that too. And there's no rule that says that you're like staying in the office until 11 o'clock or 1 a.m. every night. It's just everyone else does it, and it's part of the workday. And it would be conspicuous if you didn't. So it's just part of the job, right? And that has a dangerous way of sneaking into these sort of high pressured workplaces. So we've tried really hard to push back against that. That being said, we do have a library, and I think there are massages like once a month.
Oh, cool.
Ah,
we still doing the massages? Yeah. I don't do them. I think it's a little weird, but people are a big fan. People love these massages.
That's really good.
Joe's our resident massage enjoyer, basically. That's why he asked that. Well,
the massage enjoyer has logged on.
I used to have a job where I was, you know, like headhunters that work for agencies that try to get you a job, and if they can match up the resume with the job, they get a commission.
Yes.
I did that, yes. And the culture was basically people would be there for like 12, 13 hours a day. But during the interview, when I was applying, they told me it was going to be like 8-10 hour days at the most. So I hired on, and then I find out that after like orientation, they're like, oh, it's expected like 12-13 hours. But in my mind, I'm like, oh, that's different than what they told me during the interview. So I left after like 8 or 10 hours. Like, I don't give a, you know, I don't care. I just left, and then it didn't work out, and I hated the company, and then now I have a job that I really like, so it's cool. But it was a dishonest company, so it sounds like you guys are really, you know, compassionate towards your employees, and that's really good.
Yeah, I hope people have, like, I think everyone who works at Cards should have a good, full life. And I think people mm-hmm. should enjoy their job, but your job is not your life. It's just a thing you do for money for part of the day. And I think people are more valuable to the company, and we're a better organization if we have like full rounded human beings mm-hmm. who are not thinking about Cards Against Humanity every minute of every day. Like I like that we have like real people with outside interests and hobbies and success outside of cards that where they can bring things back and teach each other. I maybe this sounds obvious to people listening, but like, this is not how most jobs are. Like, I've never had a job where anyone was like, oh, you should have hobbies outside of work. Like, you know.
Yeah.
Every hobby was like a thing to be destroyed so that you could work better.
And speaking of which, by the way, of things we do for money, I think we should plug our final sponsor, Joe.
Oh, yeah. That's a really good idea.
But you guys got Blue Apron?
No, we have NordVPN. And people can go ahead and check out NordVPN by going to
nord.t1podcast.com.
But Joe, why would they want to do that?
Nord basically offers a variety of benefits, such as preventing you from getting hacked. It's going to secure your connection. It's going to prevent your ISP from throttling your connection. And it's going to allow you to watch The Office in French, or the French The Office, otherwise known as Le Bureau. And you ever go to Starbucks and there's somebody sitting across from you and they have like command prompt open and you can tell that they're like hacking into your computer?
Yeah, Watch Dogs 2 is real life, folks.
You need
but you can do something Nord about that. You
know, I went to go look this up. So do you guys know this website, Torrent Freak?
Yes. Yeah.
Torrent Freak is cool. They started as like a news website that was writing about sort of the world of BitTorrent, but now they're actually... they do a lot of journalism and activism around like internet freedom. And every year they publish this guide where they interview all the major VPN providers and they ask them a questionnaire. And they ask some questions like, do you keep logs of what your users do? And are you in the US? You can be like subpoenaed by the federal government, all those kind of things that you really want to know. And this is the only place where you can find this information. There's a lot of fucking sketchy ass folks. VPNs are so sketchy. There's a lot of free VPN services out there that are run by state actors, right? So they're run by like mm-hmm. the Chinese, American, Russian governments. And if you're on a VPN, you better fucking trust them, because the VPN's getting all your traffic. They're getting everything you type into Google, right? So I just went on Torrent Freak because I was going to make fun of NordVPN, because I was like, I bet these guys have bad questions on their Torrent Freak questionnaire. And they're phenomenal. They're really good.
Yeah.
They said, we do not keep any logs or timestamps that could allow our customers to be identified. They're under the jurisdiction of Panama. They don't even have any monitoring tools. So they're only able to see server load. It's quite good.
The thing about paid VPNs is that you're giving companies something, even if it's a free VPN. You're paying them with your data, basically, at that point, if they're free. I would recommend checking out NordVPN, because for just a couple bucks, they have a really good service record. They have really good benefits. And as Max said it themselves, they seem phenomenal.
Yep. I got to say, I pulled this up to make fun of them. But I can, having seen the answers to their Torrent Free questionnaire, I can heartily endorse NordVPN. Good product.
Yeah. Nord.t1podcast.com. Max, what is the name of the podcast that you're on right now?
Oh, I don't know. It's something like Level One or something.
Yeah, it's the first podcast.
There we go. The first podcast. Yeah.
And that is the checkout code at checkout. NordVPN, nord.t1podcast.com. Coupon code first, the first podcast at checkout for 75% off your first subscription. That is it for the ads.
Max, I think you just made a meme on our page because people are saying level one podcast in our chat now. And I'm pretty sure.
I don't know. These guys emailed me and they were like, will you come on? And I knew there was a one in there. That's pretty good.
Well, you were close, but not
Thank
close
you.
Enough.
Thank you. I'm a listener, obviously. I just couldn't remember their name.
All right. That's it for the ads. We can stop soulless shilling and just get back into the actual conversation.
Do you guys use NordVPN?
Yes, I use the products that we advertise.
Do you have it on your phone?
I do not.
Did you know you can do that?
Well, I should go ahead and do that, and I could probably.
It's free. I mean, for most of these things, if you're a subscriber of, I use one called like Easy VPN or something like that. But you can do it right natively in iOS. Like you can plug the VPN information in, and then there's a little toggle. And whenever I'm on like a sketchy, you know, whenever I go on like in-flight Wi-Fi on an airplane, I always put the VPN on.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I should do that. Anyway, I think we can stop talking about NordVPN now and move on to the rest of the episode. Joe, do we have anything else we should talk about?
Welcome back to the Level 1 Podcast.
Welcome back to the Level 1 Podcast. With your host, Max, and Alex, and the guests today are me, Joe, and Lars.
Yeah. Thanks for tuning in.
What do you guys talk about on this program?
It's a surrealist comedy talk show where we generally ask wacky hypothetical questions, which we've left out today.
Because you said you're not a fan.
Don't you ever get those of like, if you could be any kind of tree, what kind of tree would you be? I got asked that one time in a job interview. And I was like,
interview?
Yes. They were like, what kind of tree would you be? And I was like, why would you ask? Like, I was like, what does this tell you about the hiring? But how are you using this to determine who to hire?
Because I like to spruce up the office.
It's just like, what a fucking stupid, not for you guys. I mean, for this job thing. But like what does this tell you about me? Like, how is this informing your hiring decision? Is there some sort of tree I would pick that's the right kind of tree to work here? Like, I don't know. I'd be whatever fucking tree gets this job.
Yeah, that's what you should say.
What do you want me to be, a fucking pine tree? Done. I'll be it. Fine.
They're like, we were looking for oak tree. I'm sorry.
You know what I hate? The ones where they ask you how many windows are in New York City so they can see your reasoning. Like, I don't know.
How much would you charge? Well, this is a famous Google question. How much would you charge to wash every window in Chicago?
I mean, $1 billion?
I think you're supposed to answer a price per window.
Oh.
I think that's one of the, another one that Google's, I've heard Google, I don't think they do this anymore, but I think they used to ask, why are manhole covers round?
Because they don't fall through.
That's the correct answer, but I think they also would accept because manholes are round.
Oh, yeah. Yep. One of the traditional hypothetical questions that we typically would ask would be something like, what's your useless superpower? Have you ever thought about that, or is that, should we not ask that?
Well, I've been learning magic tricks recently, so like I can do like card tricks and stuff like that. So that's kind of a useless superpower. It's mostly a thing that bores people at parties.
That's the ability to bore people at parties.
Yeah,
that's.
Oh, good. So you're actively making yourself a more boring person.
Yeah, you know, how excited everyone is when you're like, "Hey, you guys want to see a card trick?"
By the way, it just occurred to me how much of like beginners we would sound if we were the Level 1 Podcast. Like, here at Level 1 Podcast, we always play the first level of a video game and we never level up. And we're always level one.
That's a good ass podcast. Someone should do that. That's actually very fun. Like, playing the first level of every game is a good premise for like a stream or a podcast.
Assassin's Creed, you know, for the first 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm thinking that actually has some potential.
It's really fun, like the first Mario level.
Yeah, and just like critique the entire game based on it. Yes. And
there's a whole, you can learn a lot about game design from how they tutorialize the first like 10 minutes of the game.
Lars, we should do this.
Yeah, it could be a game design theory podcast where we discuss like the intro to the games and how it sets the stage for the rest of them.
You know in Halo, how it's like the first thing it says in the game is like, look up. And then whichever way you pull the thumbstick to look up, it sets the y-axis.
Yeah, smart.
I always thought that was the most brilliant shit.
Yeah.
Do you speak any other languages?
No.
Just curious, because then you can play the video. Not really. I speak a small amount of Spanish. Like, not. I wouldn't really say it's enough to get by, but it's enough to have. Yeah, hablo un poco. Mi inglés es más bueno. Which means my English is better. I can make, like, small sentences.
Was there a reason you brought this up, Joe?
Because then you could play video games and from other countries, like Japanese video games, and not have to dub them. That was why I was asking.
Oh, is Cards Against Humanity translated into other languages?
No, because we don't speak other languages, so it's hard. How would we? So the first thing is, about a third of the game is American pop culture. So when we brought the game to, like, the UK, for example, we had to rewrite almost a third of the game because they want jokes about, like, Jimmy Savile, right? And they want jokes about fucking soccer and stuff. I don't know. And, like, you know, and they don't want, and also, like, they don't know what, like, you know, the War of 1812 is, or all the snack foods that we make fun of in America. Like, it's just like, it just doesn't translate as well. So that's a third right there. That's a third of the game that we have to change to bring it into another country. But then if you were to get into all of the wordplay, the puns, the rhyming, the idiosyncrasies of the English language that, like, make all the sort of language jokes work. I mean, you're rewriting almost the entire 600 card game at that point in a language where we don't even know if it's funny. Like, at one point we were thinking of doing this. And so we were like, let's go to Japan and, like, go see some Japanese comedy and, like, hang out with Japanese people and see if the comedy translates, right? Like, if we're on the same wavelength, so that we could sort of judge the funniness of something that we do in Japanese. And we went and hung out and did some comedy stuff and watched Japanese TV and all that good stuff. And I came away from it going, there's no fucking way. Like, we don't know enough about the culture. Like, comedy is so personal, right? Like, it's so culturally, the best comedy is so specific. It's so sharp. Like, we would just never be able to do that in another language. Yeah. And then we could hire other people to write it, but how would we know if it was any good?
What about artificial intelligence / machine learning?
We are playing with a lot of different machine learning things to write Cards Against Humanity cards. I wish I could find that. Let me see if I have it anywhere.
I was going to say, by the way, it's a wonder that things get translated at all when it comes to comedy, because it's so embedded in culture in a lot of cases. Like, it's like they redo The Simpsons in other languages, and I'm just like, how does that work?
Yeah, they made the Office in every country, right? And you can go online and look at, like, the Italian Office, and it's all weird.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even from English The Office to American The Office, it's the same language and it's very different, let alone a country that doesn't have, like the reason that, like you said earlier, the reason that we think a lot of things are funny back in 2009 was because we were going through, like, the recession and the terrible wars and stuff. And that was just a microcosm.
Yeah. Mark, I'm looking for, so we've been playing with a lot of machine learning Cards Against Humanity writing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not very good at all. But it's just, we're always poking around with it. I mean, we have a Markov chain generator that we wrote that makes some interesting cards. So these are written by a Markov chain generator, but they're curated by us. There's a fatal peanut butter erotic mystery.
It's pretty good.
8 ounces of Marlon Brandma's fingers. That's so weird. Saving the juice.
I like that.
Okay. Onions for my telephone.
It's pretty good.
Slowly fucking sand.
These are all good.
An old man and a deep beat in the catacombs. Hot wax on my wife. Worthless sauce. Big drugs in the president.
I like worthless sauce.
Discovering the nuts in it. A whole new Houston. Hot mama who likes no world. Work. A framed photocopy of a snowman who brings the balls into town. These are, I mean, they're like, they make, I think they make us laugh. Like, we sit there and read these and just, like, just cackle. But, like, some of them are just so fucking weird. You know, this one made it into the game. I forgot we came up with this. The Incredible Gary, he'll suck your nipples. So it's The Incredible Gary, camel cased, and then comma, he'll suck your nipples. That one made us laugh so hard that we just straight up put it into the game. And when we playtested it, people were like, what the hell is this? And we're like, I don't care, we're doing it anyway.
Oh, by the way, would you mind taking a quick live question? We do like to ask at least one of them from the audience.
This one's pretty good. Bames Jond.
Ames John.
How big are you, Gazpacho?
All right, go ahead, Shlong. You're unmuted.
All right, I got a question here.
All right, make it good.
Do you play Cards Against Humanity yourself?
Oh, we get an English gentleman here.
Yes.
I play the game for the purposes of playtesting, so it's kind of work for me. Like when we're workshopping cards, we sort of run it through the gauntlet of like playing the game. But I do not go to like people's parties and play cards against, like, I don't like have people over and I'm like, hey, let's play Cards Against Humanity. Like, in fact, I kind of hate playing it because for me, it's work. Like, I look at the cards all day. And like I said, we do these retreats where we're just staring at the game for like a week straight. And it's, you know, it's it's like if you worked at a chocolate factory, like you probably wouldn't go home and eat a bunch of chocolate.
Thank you, Long Shlong Silver, for the question.
Yeah, thank you for the question.
I have to know, does Long Shlong Silver, is he still there? Do you support a hard Brexit, or what do you think is going to happen? Are you going to do the Halloween exit?
I don't fucking know. I don't like going into politics that much.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it going to affect every facet of your life and like the availability of like produce and your taxes and
probably not. Economy? I don't pay taxes yet.
You don't pay taxes yet. Okay.
Nope.
Cool.
Pretty useless answer to that, Shlong. Thank you very much.
Sorry that I'm not an independent person yet.
read the news or something.
I've seen plenty of news. I'm sick of it now.
So you're okay.
We have you on our podcast, Shlong. You piss off our guest. I'm just kidding. Thank you, Shlong.
Read a web page. Google Brexit. It's a turn. I think it might be a big deal. I'm not sure. What do I know? I'm not from there.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard of it.
Shlong Silver. Are you? Can you vote? Are you old enough to vote?
Yes.
What are you voting for? Who do you like?
Oh, I don't like publicizing my votes.
You don't like publicizing your votes. Okay. Well, let's call it Corbin.
Good man.
Okay. Got a good Corbin voter here. Good man.
All right. Thank you, Shlong, for that protracted and awkward exchange. Right,
I'm going to donate $100 to, what do you have, 100 loonies to Jeremy Corbyn on your behalf.
100 loonies.
100 loonies. That's their currency there, have. I think.
Yeah.
Something like that. It's not the euro. That's for sure. All right, Joe.
British people are so funny. Why is it being so mad?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They are.
Yeah.
That's true.
At work the other day, there's this older British guy that we work with, and he's kind of this big pervert, and he'll just like stare at chicks that go by and then run into the back room where we're at, and he'll be like, guys, you've got to come out and look at this girl, she's going by right now. And like, we're like, we take a look, she's like, yeah, she's hot, but he's like very conspicuous about it. So the other day, there is this really hot girl kind of standing there, and I'm like, I glance, she's very pretty, and then I go by, I remember she was breastfeeding and her boob was out, and so I'm walking by and this guy is like, Joe, her tits out. Like, really? Like, I'm pretty sure she heard, and I'm just, and then I'm like, oh, okay, all right. And then later I go up to him,
that's,
and I'm like,
fucking, that's so fucking funny.
I was like, hey, you know, I'm gonna change his name, let's say his name was Tim. I was like, hey Tim, you know, earlier I was gonna have a conversation and subtly turn around and that way I could check her out, but then you said, hey, her tits out! And I wasn't able to anymore.
That's an unbelievable level of horniness.
There's
a woman who's breastfeeding, and you exclaim it. You're like, oh! Does he know that you can see boobs on the internet?
No, I don't think knows it.
It's possible. They're out there. I've seen them.
Yeah, I've run into one or two.
Yeah.
Yep.
Never at the same time.
Yeah, you don't have to find a breastfeeding woman and yell. You can actually just Google it in the peace of quiet of your own home.
He yelled it.
Yeah. That's cool.
That was a good one.
He's fully horny.
Yes.
He's reached maximum horniness.
Uh-huh.
10 out of 10. Horn dog potential.
Mm-hmm. He's losing, it's like when the warp core becomes unstable and you're losing structural cohesion.
Yeah, well, it looks like the gardeners have decided to mow the lawn right now, so this might be a good time to sort of wrap up. Hey, it's not a good time. I'm recording a podcast. Like, I don't think they're going to stop, though. We pay them to come over a couple times a month.
Can you come back
later?
Tight
ship you guys are running here.
Oh, man. I'm sorry.
Are you guys playing? Do you guys play games? What are you guys playing right now?
Assassin's Creed Odyssey. Stardew Valley.
Yeah, hell yeah.
The Sims 4.
I've been playing a lot of Bloodstained. Have you heard of that game?
I have not heard of that game. Tell me about it.
Okay, so you know how they used to make Castlevania games that were like side-scrollers?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so then they kind of, like, you know, Konami shift gears, and they made into, like, a 3D thing where it's not even like that anymore. But the original developers of, I think it was Symphony of the Night, banded together to make a new game, which just came out, like, I think about a month ago, called Bloodstained.
Oh, I did hear about this, yeah.
Yeah, it was done on Kickstarter, by the way,
right,
I think.
That's right. Yeah, I think you're right. Yep.
And people were kind of hesitant about it, like, oh, I don't know if it's going to recapture the magic, but they ended up releasing it to rave reviews, and it's just really good. If you like the old Castlevanias, I highly recommend picking it up.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's right up my alley. I'm going to check that out. Who's playing Stardew Valley?
Me.
That seems like a dangerous game. I feel like that's a game I probably shouldn't get too into.
It's pretty good. You basically play, so you inherit your grandfather's farm, and then it's pretty good, not gonna lie. It lets you kind of upgrade as you go and level up, and I really like that.
It's like an Animal Crossing kind of a situation. There's like townspeople and relationship. Yeah, but like, it just seems like I could easily put 1,000 hours into that game.
I talked to the guy who made it on Twitter. I was like, hey, you made a really great game. He's like, thank you.
You know what I'm playing is, so I really love the XCOM franchise, and I played XCOM 2, and I had a great time with it. And they put this expansion out, War of the Chosen, which just kind of came and went. Like, I never revisited it. And then for some reason over the long weekend, I was like going through my Steam games, and I was like, oh, I guess I have this XCOM expansion, and I booted it up, and I was like, I guess I'll play the like DLC or whatever. And it's not, so it's not, it's a whole new game. It basically, they did a complete retooling of XCOM 2, and you play from the beginning with like new classes of soldiers, completely new mission structure, new enemies. Like it's like basically a new XCOM game.
Wasn't there a controversial change between XCOM and XCOM 2 though? Like turn limits or something?
Are you thinking of when they made basically like Enemy Unknown, like when they moved to the modern XCOM?
Yeah, I think so.
See, like I love the modern X, like I love Enemy Unknown, and then the new one or whatever, XCOM 2 or whatever. But this, like, if people have it, I think it's probably cheap now on Steam. But like, War of the Chosen is the like expansion for XCOM 2, and like, whew, it's fucking, it's good. It's hard, really challenging, and really good. And I'm terrible. Like, I'll like save hack it so I don't lose my squad.
Oh, okay.
Like, I can't have like a squad wipe. It's emotionally devastating.
Isn't that kind of the point though? Like, to have it mean something?
Probably, but not for me.
Oh well.
Yeah.
You ever play The Sims?
Yeah, I love The Sims.
So I've recently decided to start up again on The Sims, and I basically decided to create this character that was just going to be like always dating, never going to work, never having to do anything besides dating. And like, she's working on her stand up career. And the way I was going to achieve this was I activated the cheats that allows the DK meter, the requirements like food and sanitation to like never go down. So she's always happy. And so she's also, so she never has to sleep, which allows her to live in the club.
What's the point?
Like, you know, the nightclub there? So she lives in the nightclub, always just dating people. I put a computer office in there with an office with like a computer, but like the other Sims were using it. So I put like 4 of them in there. There's restrooms in there because the other Sims in the club need to use the restroom. So, but my Sim doesn't. But then I was like, oh, it's a nightclub. So what do people do?
So they want to just neutered the game.
Maybe if he gets really lucky, he'll see a woman breastfeeding.
Yeah, maybe. But the Sims want a woohoo. That's the point of the nightclub. So I put in like a bunch of beds on the side of the nightclub, but they didn't want to use it. So I had to put up like walls in order to separate the nightclub from the beds to get them to want to use the beds in the club. And then it worked. And so there's Sims woohooing right there in the nightclub.
All right, do you have to notify any like schools when you move into a new neighborhood?
No, I don't. I do not know. Thank you for asking.
Good. It's not a good question. I understand.
Not at all.
Okay.
But isn't that funny? It basically, it's like a brothel.
Do you guys know about the painting goblin?
No.
You can look it up. Go look up Painting Goblin The Sims. It's like classic, right now? Classic copypasta. Yeah, sure.
Making the Painting Goblin making cash in The Sims 4? Is that the one?
Well, don't watch some YouTuber. There's an original like copypasta of the Painting Goblin. Chat, uh-oh, find the Painting Goblin. Find us the copypasta.
Is it this one on
Does the chat
Reddit
work like Alexa? Like, chat.
Oh, yes, it does. Find Can somebody thing in the chat find us the original copypasta of the Painting Goblin, please?
Yeah, someone found it.
Apparently you turned on somebody's Alexa. I'm going to do the same right now.
Alexa, order Cards Against Humanity. Alexa, confirm.
Hey, Siri, play Despacito.
All right.
No, no, Siri, not really. God damn it. Hold on, let me turn this off.
Are you angling for us to read this on air, or should we just like save it for later?
Yeah, it's like fun. It's short, right?
Every time I play The Sims, I start my family with a quote-unquote painting goblin. I make him slash her morbidly obese with green skin. I make sure to give him the following traits. Green text, likes to be alone, likes art, hates the outdoors. The first thing I do once I have enough money is to build a small room in the basement, send him down there, and then remove the stairs. I set him up in a tiny little area with only an easel, a toilet, a refrigerator, a bed, a shower, and a trash bin. All he does is paint. That's it. He paints and paints and paints and paints. Eventually his paintings become very good and worth a lot of money. Every few minutes I go downstairs and sell whatever painting he has finished, and then I return to playing the game. My family always ends up feeling blessed because of their fortune, and they never found out about the horrible secret living beneath their home.
They don't even know he's there.
Oh my god, that's wow, so funny. I mean,
okay.
They don't even know he's there. That's morbid. That's grotesque.
Yeah.
That's so
4chan, funny, man.
Oh man.
That's all I'm gonna say. People are linking Toy Story 2's Wikipedia article in the chat for some reason. Not sure why that's the case. If people wanted to tune into these live, though, Joe, how can they do that?
Discord.t1podcast.com.
Yep. And if they tune in live, you'll let some of your generation identity, crypto-fascist, UKIP weirdos come on and ask questions to the guests, right?
Yeah, that's AKA at discord.level1podcast.com. Okay. Mm.
That guy's definitely gonna like yell out a Ben Shapiro quote before he shoots up a mosque.
We'll hear about your feelings.
Long John Silver. We'll hear about it in the news next week.
Maybe. Yeah.
If people have been tuning in to the first podcast, not the Level One podcast, for a while, and they've been enjoying what they've been hearing, and they wanted to help support the show in a way that gets some cool little benefits on the Discord and the Patreon itself, how can they go ahead and do that?
I would recommend going to patreon.com/T1podcast.
There they can find, for just $2 a month, early access to every single episode, bonus episodes of the show, which only you guys can hear because you're special and they're secret. You get a special role in the Discord, you get patron-only hangouts, and a bunch of other cool stuff. The tiers start at $2 a month. Please remember to help the content creators that you enjoy. I'm going to go ahead and say that I think this episode is going to trigger literally everyone's Echo Dots. I really enjoy that.
And Siri's.
Yep.
Hey, Siri.
Okay, Google, lights off.
No, not really, Siri.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.